So honored to be able to speak to public health people. I'm a historian. I want you to look at these two pictures because I want to talk about women and their bodies. The first picture of a woman at her graduation, the one on the left, she received so much hate mail after this picture was posted on the internet that she had to take it down. The second picture received nothing but positive words. What does that tell us? The human body has never stood free of social and historical power relations. Anyone like you works in the public health field knows how inequalities are of class, of race, of imperialism, even of religion, are marked on the body and in the body through nutrition, disease, disability, stress, and energy. I recently wrote a book about the great photographer Dorothea Lange, and I discovered something that no one knew, which is that one third of all of her photographs were photographs of people of color. Some of you may know this famous picture, often named the most famous picture in America, which has been called Migrant Mother, of a woman who's posed like this with her two children. It's a Madonna, really. And Lange made many Madonnas, and I'd like to show you a few of her other ones. Just these three. This is a woman in San Francisco in 1932. This is a Mexican-American migrant farm worker. This is an African-American migrant farm worker. She made many extraordinary Madonnas like this, but not one of these photographs of black women with their children was released during the Depression. The boss of the program said that America wasn't ready for photographs like these. This kind of history leaves its marks long after many people assume that history is history. In fact, history is here with us today. And when it comes to reproduction, these historical injustices combine with today's injustices, and they produce a lot of combinations and sometimes irrational and even contradictory combinations. When I think of contradictions, I think of the fact that many of the very people who benefit most from so-called Obamacare are those who vote for politicians who want to repeal it. That many of those who have the most gain from reproductive rights oppose those rights. But in fact, I think that some of these contradictions are not really irrational if we remember that the past is never past. So I want to start with a few general facts from American history, facts about the body, though, and then work my way to reproductive rights. One interesting racial comparison provides rule for thought. Many of you are probably familiar with what was often called the one-drop rule in relation to people of African descent, and that is that if you had one so-called drop of black blood, you were considered black. Now, this rule served to increase the black population and thus increase the number of people who could be enslaved and later number of people who could be exploited as sharecroppers and so on. By contrast, American Indians lived with the opposite rule, in which one drop of white blood made a person not Indian. And this rule worked very well to reduce the population of Indians, which was the priority of the European white settlers. Enslaved women, another contradiction, were coerced to produce many children, but at the same time, they were subjected to working and living conditions that could only be expected to reduce their fertility. When effective contraception became available toward the beginning of the 20th century, a combination of legal and economic inequality created a class double standard in access to this contraception. Modern contraceptives, pessaries, and vaginal diaphragms were first available in European socialist-run health clinics starting in the very end of the 1800s, but spreading in the early 20th century. Wealthy Americans would travel to Europe, visit these clinics, get these contraceptives, and smuggle them into the United States where they were illegal. Private doctors soon found that it was profitable for them to outfit their well-to-do patients with diaphragms at a time when the majority of Americans never visited a private doctor. When Margaret Sanger's work as a visiting nurse took her into immigrant homes on the Lower East Side in New York, the mothers she met begged her for abortions because that was all they knew. And when she told them that there were preventives, as she called them then, they were, of course, very eager for those. So soon, Margaret Sanger and other leftists, based on their class analysis of inequality, started a birth control movement, which spread really rapidly throughout the United States starting in about 1914. Now, it was a very hard struggle. The same problems that hamper progressive social change today held them back. There was religious zealotry, there was hostility to women's rights, both from the left and the right, and above all, there was lack of electoral democracy. You have to remember that at that time, no women could vote, and 95% of African Americans were also disfranchised. So it's not surprising that it took them 50 years until 1965 to make contraception legal throughout the United States. Now, Margaret Sanger looked for support wherever she could get it, and she saw two potential allies groups. One was physicians, and the other was eugenists. Let me take the physicians first. A lot of physicians were very eager to help, but they felt that they wanted to retain control of birth control. And birth control had never previously been considered a medical issue. Keep in mind that it does not really require medical training to fit a woman with a vaginal diaphragm, that most people could learn to do this with just a couple of hours of training and practice, and no matter what you do wrong, a diaphragm can't hurt you. Besides, it's a cheap, mass-produced item, and it could have been available as a low-price, over-the-counter item, like condoms, which were available. Instead, the medicalization of contraception worked for many, many decades to prevent access to the poor, and that, in turn, further strengthened American inequality. Now, equally damaging was the alliance with eugenists. This pseudoscience of human breeding, and I'm sure you're mostly familiar with it, is the idea that you can breed a superior human race by choosing carefully those with the right genes. And it was based on what we now know to be completely faulty genetics, but in fact, it was a dominant so-called science in the 1920s. It was a required course. Eugenics was a required course in many American universities. Now, these intellectuals who were eugenists preached that people of color and Catholic and Jewish immigrants were genetically inferior. One of my favorite examples, because it so shocks my students, was to show them documents that assert that people of Chinese and Japanese descent were incapable of being educated. Now, the idea was if professors and doctors had big families, the population would be smarter. And if poorly educated people had big families, the population would become dumber. These eugenists saw in the birth control movement an opportunity to restrict the fertility of the subordinated people. And Sanger and her allies hoped that the eugenics would help the birth control cause. I actually don't think that support did much for her cause, especially since eugenics promoted extremely reactionary ideas about women's autonomy. And the birth control eugenics alliance provoke very, very stiff resistance among people of color, needless to say. In fact, I've been personally hounded by this history. The right wing frequently cites my work to prove that birth control is a racist plot. Look for it on the web. You'll find it easily. I'm sure you've seen or know about the billboards in Black and Latina neighborhoods showing images of babies or tots with the accompanying text, "The most dangerous place for an African-American baby is in the womb." In the Latino neighborhoods, el lugar más peligroso para un Latino es en el vientre de su madre. Now, eugenics actually preferred sterilization to contraception because A, sterilization is permanent, and B, it isn't within women's area of choice. Well before the Nazis came to power in Germany and began their sterilization practices, American governments carried out large-scale coercive sterilizations of people of color. In the 1920s, some 64,000 allegedly feeble-minded, aka also called genetically defective people, were forcibly sterilized in this country. The birth controllers soon completely left this alliance, but the policies that had been installed by eugenists did not stop. In Puerto Rico, between the 1930s and the 1970s, one-third of all women were sterilized. And this was achieved with some very fancy footwork on the part of the Catholic hierarchy, who maintained that while contraception continued to be wrong, that sterilization could be allowed. And one study from that period showed that only 1% of Puerto Rican women had ever heard of vaginal diaphragms. But even when no legal force was applied, poverty alone made many people, up to so as far as much as 20% in the 1960s, accept sterilization because the state would offer to pay for it, while they would not pay for childbirth. And the middle, this double standard had now twisted because it was actually extremely difficult for a middle class white woman to get a voluntary sterilization. They had a formula designed by the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology that you take a woman's age and you multiply it by the number of children she has, and the number had to reach 120 before a sterilization could be allowed, and then only if two doctors plus a psychiatrist recommended it. Meanwhile, coerced sterilizations of poor women, very particularly American Indians, were going on. I focus on this particularly because I wanted to call to your attention a particular organization that arose in the 1970s out of the women's movement. It was eventually a coalition of organizations that came together, called themselves CARASA, C-A-R-A-S-A, which stood for the Coalition for Abortion Rights and Against Sterilization Abuse. And this coalition included the National Black Feminist Organization, the Puerto Rican Socialist Party, the Young Lords, and the National Women's Health Network. And they developed a program of reproductive rights that I think deserves our attention today. Its core principle is that choice has to include the right to bear as well as the right not to bear children. More, that the right to have children safely and to keep them in good health is as much a reproductive right as the freedom to engage in sexual relations without bearing children. And in this ethic, we see not only the influence of the birth control movement, including the abortion rights movement, but also the influence of the National Welfare Rights Organization, an important organization, a part of the women's movement of poor, largely black mothers. This is an ethic that wanted to, this whole ethic of seeing reproductive rights as going in both directions is one that really tried to mitigate the inequality that was embedded in today's reproductive health situation. Now, since the 1980s, as we all know, that program has been under assault along several axes. The first major victory for inequality was the Hyde Amendment, which banned the use of federal funds for abortion, meaning that poor women could get help in giving birth to children, but not in preventing unwanted births. The second victory was the steady erosion of access to abortions through a thicket of restrictions that you all know about that I cannot possibly summarize, but also a terrifying campaign of violence. And some of you may be young enough that you don't remember this vividly. So from 1977 through 2001, the assailants in this campaign murdered 3 doctors, 2 clinic employees, 1 clinic escort, 1 security guard, attempted 71 other murders, executed 41 bombings, 165 arson attacks, 82 attempted bombings, 372 clinic invasions. This is scary stuff, and it was enough to drive even staunch supporters of reproductive rights out of the practice of providing abortions. And those who remained are absolute heroes. After a while, the public revulsion against this violence reduced but did not eliminate this violence. One of the organizations responsible for this, called Operation Save America, they're the ones that put out the, you may have seen the so-called wanted posters, which show a picture of a physician who does abortions, and often with that person's home address. As I understand it, maybe Kanisha can tell me if I'm wrong, but I understand that the mayor of this city just 2 days ago offered an official welcome to that organization, Operation Save America. A third defeat for reproductive rights, which not a lot of people understand is really part of this same struggle, was the repeal of aid to dependent children in 1996. That repeal has made us the only developed country without any guarantee of support for poor children. The logic here really is just ethically stunning, because the logic is that poor people have to give birth but get no help for maintaining the welfare of their children. Then there was another defeat, and that is the failure of the Clinton era attempt to create medical insurance. There was certainly a victory with the passage of the Affordable Care Act, although it was already weakened a lot by not only the congressional opposition, but also by the elimination at the very beginning of a single payer option. And then, finally, one of the last attacks, the Republicans in the red states have begun, including my former home state of Wisconsin, defunding Planned Parenthood and other similar women's health clinics. And I was going to review what those clinics do, but I don't think that's necessarily fair. I'm here to speak for Planned Parenthood and just to say that these clinics are a hugely important source of basic health care for a lot of poor women and men. And finally, the most recent defeat was a Supreme Court decision honoring so-called religious options to providing contraception. All of this has to be seen, I think, in line with a large context for this panel, which is the question of overall inequality in the United States, and not just reproductive inequality. It's part of a massive, I think, corporate assault on any progress toward greater equality and a decent standard of living. But I don't want to raise... I waste your time preaching to the choir, because I'm sure you all know much of that. But I do think that many of even the liberal allies of reproductive rights could do a better job of communicating the overall ethical bases of reproductive rights. This has to be an approach that situates what has been called choice as a real and not a theoretical right. It's not real choice if one has no access to health care that provides birth control. It's not real if you're forced into an abortion by poverty any more than if you're forced into an unwanted childbirth. And it's not real if we can't raise our children in good health. Thanks very much.
Thank you for gracious consideration.